This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Chances are good you've heard of Helen Keller, probably the most famous blind and deaf person in the world. She overcame her disabilities thanks to the Perkins School for the Blind, located right in Watertown, and she went on to become one of the 20th century's leading humanitarians.
But you probably haven't heard of Laura Bridgman, even though she's sometimes described as a Helen Keller before Helen Keller. Bridgman grew up in New Hampshire and went to the Perkins School 50 years before Keller did. Bridgman became so well known that Charles Dickens said she was his primary motivation for visiting the United States.
That's because she, not Helen Keller, was the first deaf and blind person to learn language. But today, Laura Bridgman's name is mostly forgotten. Bridgman's voice, though, gets a new life in a new novel by Cambridge writer Kimberly Elkins. It's called What is Visible, and Elkins will be reading from her book tonight at the New England Mobile Book Fair. But first, she's joining us in the Radio Boston studio. And Kimberly Elkins, welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here.
And, you know, I first want to make sure we point out that Laura Bridgman wasn't just deaf and blind. This is a woman that, because of scarlet fever as a child, lost almost every sense you can lose except touch. She didn't smell. She didn't taste. So she really lost, largely, the human sensory experience.
Yes. She was, some people would consider that maybe the worst sort of punishment, you know, sort of being confined to this dark and silent cell without even the sense of taste or smell. But she really had a very rich and complex inner life.
You, as I understand it, first found out about her because the New Yorker magazine, and I think about a decade ago, maybe 2001, had a
yes.
biography of her.
Yes.
And you were so taken with her that you decided to write about her, but not just another full biography. You wanted to write about her in the first person, from inside her head. Why did you decide you wanted to do that?
Well, there was a photograph of Laura, along with the article in The New Yorker. And she was sitting there, ramrod straight, with her head held high, this ribbon across her eyes, reading from this enormous raised letter book. And something about the photograph moved me more profoundly than I've ever been moved by any other person, in combination with what I read about her. And I thought, I know this woman, and I want to get to know her more. I want to get inside her head. And that night, I went home and stayed up until dawn and wrote the short story that appeared shortly thereafter in The Atlantic of the same name. That's how much she got into my head right away and into my heart.
Did you feel like you would identify with her for some reason?
Well, yes, and it's taken me a while to figure out why I identified with her. The sense of what resonated with me was the profound sense of separateness and isolation, because I'm someone who has suffered for most of my life with severe depression, though I'm happy to say for 4 years now.
Good.
It's been a miracle, and that's how the book got done. If I hadn't gotten on the right medication, the book would never have been written.
So you felt a connection with her in terms of sort of being cut off from other people.
Being cut off from other people, yes.
So as we said, even though many people, as you've discovered, really haven't heard of Laura Bridgman, she was, at least in her youth and early 20s and so forth, very well known. I mean, people came to the Perkins School to see her. There were these Laura dolls you write about in which the eyes were poked out and green ribbons would be tied around the head, and apparently these were sold across the country. They were popular.
Yes.
What made her such an attraction?
It was at a time when there had never really been a disabled, especially severely disabled person who was exhibited as anything more than a curiosity. There had been the Elephant Man. There had been the, I think she was called the African Venus, who was exhibited. But this was the first time that they had sort of tried to do a sort of socio
kind of scientific
experiment and let the public be part of it. And also she was really romanticized, especially by Dickens. So people came to see, you know, the poor little tragic girl, watch her write on the board and, you know, read people's faces and have conversations with her fingers.
And she was taught to do this by another very key character in your book, a real man named Dr. Samuel Gridley Howe. He founded Perkins, and he seemed to have taken her on as a project. He wanted to show the world that someone who was deaf and blind and had lost other senses as well could learn to read, and she did.
Oh, she was so remarkable that not only did she learn to read and write, she had a vast correspondence with most of the presidents during her lifetime, and that continued throughout her life, her correspondence. But when she was sort of tragically parted from her teacher at the age of 20, at that time she was learning French and Latin.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yes.
Not with Braille, right? It was a different kind of sort of tactile sign language variation of?
Yes. Dr. Howe didn't approve of Braille. He called it, you know, maybe because the French invented it. Braille was around, but Perkins didn't start using it until much later. And Dr. Howe, she communicated by basically American Sign Language written out into the hand. So the other person also had to know this sign language, and it is called tactile sign language.
So very labor intensive, but it worked for her. It gave her access to the rest of the world. She could express herself, and she could understand what other people wanted to convey to her.
It did. She lived to connect with others. She really did.
Her relationship with this doctor is key to this book. And as I read it, it seems very clear that she had a crush on him. I think she was in love with him, maybe an unrequited love of sorts. I mean, she wanted a love life, even though the doctor seemed to think this is a woman who will never be able to have one. And in fact, he married someone else.
Yes, he married Julia Ward Howe, the famous poet and abolitionist and suffragist who wrote The Battle Hymn of the Republic.
And your book, in alternating chapters, tells the story through largely those three people. It's a fascinating approach, I think. There's Laura Bridgman's view, there's the doctor's view, there's the wife's view. I came to view
and
it
the
as
teacher.
And the teacher, exactly.
The last teacher.
I came, as I read it, to focus on those three. It felt to me like it became almost a love triangle of sorts.
And Charles Sumner in there, too, yes. Yeah, I did that. Originally, the book was planned to be all in Laura's voice, as the short story was, and I wrote about a third of it that way. And frankly, I know and love her voice so well I could write 1,000 pages in her voice. But I realized that because she had only the sense of touch and the writer communicates to the reader primarily through the senses, that it was probably going to be very claustrophobic for the reader.
Oh, that's an interesting writing decision.
So then I made the choice to include the other narrators, but have them in third person.
You referenced earlier that tragic parting of Laura Bridgman from the doctor, and this happens when she's 20. She's basically learned everything she can learn at Perkins, and he decides it's time for her to go back to New Hampshire and live with her family. And as I read this book, I felt that in a way Laura was badly used. I mean, people would come and watch her, but there was sort of a circus attraction element to it. It seemed that and you even say this in your book, that in a way she became a pawn for the doctor. Can you talk a little bit about how she might have been not well used sometimes?
Well, she was a pawn to help him become more famous. I mean, he did care about her, and he did care about the blind students at Perkins. But she became a pawn largely in a religious battle. I mean, it's sort of hard to understand now how important this was, but Boston and much of the country, but especially New England, was divided into the Unitarians and the Calvinists, which were basically all the other Protestants, and then the Catholics. And Dr. Howe was an ardent Unitarian, and they believed that children should not be taught the scripture or taught the Bible, and they didn't really believe that much in the truth of the exact words of the Bible. So he delayed her religious education until she was 12. And when he found out that he'd been away for 18 months on his honeymoon and that she had been, as he said, contaminated by the Calvinist because so many people visited, you know, and slipped her religious pamphlets and some of the teachers interpreted them for her, when he found out that she wanted to become a Baptist, this is his worst nightmare, And that's a big part of the reason that he sent her back to New Hampshire, where she almost starved to death because she was anorexic.
Because she couldn't taste food, so there was really no pleasure in eating, so why eat?
And then he let her come back to Perkins and stay there the rest of her life. But she was no longer a celebrity, and he denigrated her in the press. He had written glowingly of her, and the reports were circulated all over the world. And at the age of 20, he said he'd made a mistake. And that
By educating her?
Yes, and that she was small-brained. That was the word he used.
So he really turned on her in a way.
Subject to derangement. He totally turned on her.
You know, reading your book also made me realize that if you are going to educate someone like that, you then have to make sure that you have something meaningful for them to do after they've gained all that knowledge and education. And it seemed like after he finished his experiment, he was done.
He was. The biggest thing about being deaf, blind, not even to mention the taste and smell part, is having someone to interpret the world for you. And Helen Keller had Annie Sullivan almost her entire life. It's not like having a teacher until you're 18. If you're deaf and blind, you need someone there to write into your head, to interpret the world for you. And Helen Keller said late in life that if Laura had had Annie Sullivan, had continued to have a teacher, if they continued to pay for a teacher, which they didn't, that she would have far outshone Helen.
Despite all the sadness we're talking about in Laura Bridgman's life, did you come away from this book thinking that she had a happy, fulfilling life?
I did, yes. It definitely does not have a fairy tale ending, but I think she did have a happy life. She, unlike Helen Keller, who, for instance, got blue glass eyes, which was hidden from the public.
Fake eyes.
For her entire life. Laura remained completely true to herself, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, even sexually. And in my eyes, that makes her a fairly inimitable heroine.
It's a wonderful book. I really enjoyed reading it, and I really love that you gave someone who seems like a distant historical figure a sense of being a real person with real desires and disappointments and wants. It's a wonderful way to fictionalize a real person and really make them real. So this
Thank
is Kimberly.
You.
You're very welcome. Kimberly Elkins. She's a Cambridge-based writer. She's the author of the new historical novel, What is Visible?, which is about Laura Bridgman, sometimes described as the Helen Keller before Helen Keller. Kimberly, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Coming up, how a love of animals, a love of nature, all come together for a love of learning at the Norfolk County Agricultural High School. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.